You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my fellow Muppets, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Yeah, Muppets, that's what Goldman Sachs refers to. You know, Goldman Sachs thinks you're a Muppet. Former Goldman Sachs executive director Greg Smith recently resigned from the banking giant, and today, in an op-ed in the New York Times, he blew the whistle on what he called a toxic and destructive environment within the bank. Smith wrote, "I believe I have worked here long enough to understand the trajectory of its culture, its people, and its identity, and I can honestly say that the environment now is as toxic and destructive as I have ever seen it." Smith went on to write that the banksters at the firm callously rip off their clients and routinely refer to their customers as Muppets. Most shocking, Smith reveals that the most common question he gets from fellow banksters is, "How much money can we make off that client?" The dangerous part of this is the banksters like Goldman Sachs now make up more than a quarter of our economy. They used to make up about a tenth. A quarter of our economy used to be manufacturing. Now that's about a tenth. And banking used to be about a tenth of our economy. Now it's about a quarter. That means one-fourth of all the money in the United States comes from banksters on Wall Street preying on their customers with things like exploding mortgages and fees, jacking up oil and food prices by gambling on them, and making a profit crashing the economies of entire nations like Greece and Spain and, oh yeah, the United States. This process is called financialization. It's what's happened to our economy over the last, really over the last 15 years. Although this really goes back to what was the last year of the George Herbert Walker Bush administration? That would have been in 92. 1992, Wendy Graham, who had been appointed as head of the CFTC. Well, let me get to that in just a second. Let's actually start at the beginning. Ken Lay. Back in 92, he wanted to make money hustling energy derivatives, but it was illegal, right? They had been regulated since the Great Crash in 1929, well, since 1935. So the chairwoman of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, she was appointed by Ronald Reagan in 1988, and in 92 she was still on the job. Last year, the Bush Elder administration, she made a special exemption for Enron. 6 days after she did it, 6 days later, she resigned her position as head of the CFTC and 5 weeks later became a director of Enron, making millions. Who was this woman? After she did this, Ken Lay's Enron Corporation set up over 2,000 subsidiary corporations, over 800 of them offshore in tax havens, and began jacking up the price of electricity, especially in California. And I'm going to get to what all this has to do with last night's elections, by the way. In fact, the whole point of all this is what we saw last night down in Mississippi and Alabama. But you have to know the backstory. Ken Lay had a secret meeting with movie actor Arnold Schwarzenegger, and shortly thereafter in California, big trouble. Rolling energy shortages, disasters. Price of energy going through the roof, Governor Gray Davis in big trouble. Meanwhile, that woman who had been the head of the CFTC, who was she? Well, her name was Wendy Graham, who left the CFTC after giving a special exemption to Enron. 5 days later, left. 5 weeks later, she's on the board of directors of Enron. Her husband was Senator Phil Graham, who got over $1 million from Enron for his campaigns. He pushed legislation in Congress to deregulate derivatives so that Enron and Goldman Sachs and other companies could make billions with a B. Arguably trillions. Graham pushed this piece of legislation called the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, and then another one called Gramm-Leach-Bliley that blew up Glass-Steagall that allowed giant banks to get even bigger and to get into the gambling business. And with a year after the time that Graham's legislation passed in 2000, Enron's wholesale revenue quadrupled to over $40 billion, and other banksters got into the game. Enron's bets took them down, you know, crashed the company. There was no government bailout for Enron. But what happened was the business that Enron had been in, or at least the bankster side of that business, just kind of rolled over to Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers. They kept making the exact same kind of bets that Wendy Graham had sort of legalized in 92 by giving Enron an exemption, and that Phil Graham had totally legalized in 2000 and 2001, these two laws that I was telling you about. So when the banksters crashed the same way Enron crashed, only they crashed in 2008, George W. Bush bailed them out. You know, since Ken Lay and Phil and Wendy Graham got into the game on behalf of Enron, the banksters on Wall Street have gone from making modest salaries to over $1 billion a year per person. Yep, there's about 20 guys on Wall Street making more than $1 billion with a B, $1 billion a year. And then in 2010, the Supreme Court said these billionaires could begin to buy politicians and flip elections with their money, which is where we're getting now to Mississippi and Alabama. The Citizens United decision came along, and what it said basically was, you got enough money, you can corrupt Congress, no problem. And the banksters said, cool, we got the money. They got to own their very own Republican candidates for president. Several Wall Street banksters are among Mitt Romney's biggest multi-million-dollar funders. And another Wall Street guy by the name of Foster Freeze, he owns Ricky Santorum. So it's kind of Wall Street versus Wall Street here. This didn't really start with Citizens United. That was kind of the high water mark. It really started with Ronald Reagan appointing Wendy Graham to head the CFTC and Ken Lay making her and her husband an offer they couldn't refuse. The Grahams, by the way, are now retired and incredibly, incredibly rich, and our democracy is immeasurably poorer. So, America, we're all financial Muppets now. And Santorum, funded by a Wall Street billionaire, Romney, funded by a Wall Street billionaire, are the two leading candidates. And the guy funded by a casino billionaire, Newt Gingrich, funded by Shelley Adelson, he's not so happy today. He came in second in both those primaries last night. Romney came in third. This is going to be problematic for him. But really the big picture here in my mind is that what we're seeing is banksters go up against banksters. And, you know, that's a pretty ugly thing. Bankster on bankster crime. No, it's really, we no longer have presidential candidates. What we have are banksters buying front men. I mean, and front men who will say anything to get elected. Mitt Romney coming out, I believe it was this morning, might have been last night, saying, yeah, we're going to do away with Planned Parenthood. Or, yeah, we're going to, you know, he's got this long list of just kind of wackadoodle things that he's, and actually he corrected that. He wasn't going to do it. He was just going to cut their federal funding. This is just this whole spectrum of stuff that is happening. The longer the American public watches this Republican clown show and sees these guys call for the end of Medicare as we know it, the privatization of Social Security, let's just turn it over to Goldman Sachs. Speaking of Goldman Sachs, today, Greg Smith, an executive director of Goldman Sachs and head of the firm's United States equity derivatives business in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa, resigned. And on the day he resigned, he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times saying, basically, this place rips people off. It's turned into a culture of greed that I can't be part of anymore. They call their customers Muppets. Every question is, how much can we squeeze out of this guy? Pretty amazing, when you think about it. And you kind of wonder, what is this going to do to Goldman stock? So, anyhow, I've got to tell you about the cherry blossoms. An amazing story about the cherry blossoms here in Washington, D.C. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It actually has to do with the oil companies. Anyhow, well, Muppets, what should we do about the banksters? 866-987-THOM. Our talk.
Phenomena.
Yeah, we're all Muppets now, according to Goldman Sachs, so it's a whole hour of Muppets music for bumpers. Jacob was so excited about this. Okay, a quickie, and then I'm going to pick up your calls here. As climate changes, the tidal basin cherry blossoms. Louise and I were walking home last night, And it's amazing, all the cherry trees that are blossoming. Actually, I think we first noticed it a couple of days ago, and we were talking about, you know, when are they supposed to blossom? I mean, we were here last year, and I thought it was a little later than this. But it turns out that it looks like this year is going to beat the 2000 record, and the cherry blossoms are blooming about 10 days, about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks earlier than the historical date, you know, going back to 1921. D.C. keeps the records. And I believe it was 1912 that the Japanese made this huge gift of these two kinds of cherry trees to Washington, D.C., which are scattered all over the city. So if you don't think global warming is happening, come to D.C., check out the cherry blossoms. Anyhow, Dino, listening to WWRL in New York City. Hey, Dino, what's on your mind?
What's up, Tom? How you doing, buddy, first
Good.
Of all, right?
Good. What's up?
At least, finally, my prayers have been answered. You're live. Oh, my God.
Well, thank you. So what do you want to talk about?
I mean, well, all right. Well, I want to talk about, first of all, I agree with you. I'm a right-wing conservative, just so you know. I'm not going to beat around the bush and play this, that, and the other thing. I'm a right-wing conservative. But I agree with you as far as any corruption, you know, government-wise, being whatever it was, Enron or, you know, solar companies now, this and that. Prosecute to the full extent of the law. I agree with you 1,000,000%.
Sure. I think that's something that everybody can agree on. I'm curious, what makes you a right-wing conservative? What is it that causes you to think that that's who you are?
I'll explain to you. I thought I was a liberal or more libertarian up until high school, college, and then...
No, what is it? Give me an issue. Give me a, you know, what is it that you believe that causes...
I moved to Europe for 11 years, and I lived in a socialist country. Oh! Turned you into a right-wing conservative all the way.
Really?
All you got to do is live under it. You know how they say...
I had the opposite experience. I lived in Germany for a year, and I came out going, wow, this is amazing. You know, you walk into a doctor's office and say, I'd like to see a doctor, and 15 minutes later, you're sitting there talking to one.
Well, that's
and it's
like,
free.
Exactly. Cause like, you lived in Germany, and there's like a lot of misconceptions like going on as far as you talk to people, and you would think America is the biggest, meanest polluter in the world.
Yeah.
And like you yourself, you lived in Germany, and I lived in Germany. 1986, I left New Jersey.
Yeah, that's the year Louise and I moved to Germany. We lived there 86, 87.
So you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. For tax reasons, I lived in Greece, but I traveled throughout the year because I was in the sales business.
Yeah.
And I shipped my Volkswagen Scirocco from here over there, you know, only cost me $400. In 1986, I'm going to fill gas. You know, I took it off the boat. They landed in Dover, in London. I got out. I'm driving through Europe. I go to fill up gas in Germany, and there's no unleaded gasoline.
Right. They did not want to poison their people with lead.
No. You see the misinformation. Because it's cattle. Why is there lead? Why is there no lead gasoline? Why was there no unleaded gas? They had lead back then. I'm sorry. You're wrong.
Oh, you're saying there was no unleaded gasoline.
There was no unleaded gasoline because they had lead in their gas still.
Oh, okay.
They didn't start unleaded gasoline until about a decade ago.
Okay, so they were behind that curve. Why does that make you a right-wing conservative?
No. I would answer that. You flipped over. What made me a right-wing conservative is living under socialism. But to give you misinformation is that, you know how everybody thinks we're the biggest polluters? We're one of the cleanest industrial countries in the world by far.
That's because we don't make anything in here anymore. It's only 10% of our economy now. You've had 60,000 factories close in the last 10 years in America.
Anything for other reasons. I mean, look at the car companies. You know, you got Toyota, BMW from Germany. Mercedes-Benz has a factory in Alabama.
Right, and they're manufacturing here because labor is $14 an hour, and in Germany, labor is $46 an hour.
But our American car companies are being sold to Italy. I mean, we're
yep.
totally off.
That's because of our trade deficit. That's because insane economic policies have led to a trade. But still, I haven't heard anything, Dino. And I've got to move along to other callers here. But I haven't heard anything yet that you could say. Okay, here's what a right winger believes that I believe. You know, do you believe, for example, that there should be no public education, no public schools?
Oh, I'm definitely for public.
Okay, education. Do you believe that Social Security and all the $2.5 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund should be turned over to Goldman Sachs?
No.
Okay. Do you believe that people on Medicare should be told, you know, go out and buy some insurance? Good luck. Here's a voucher.
My friend, I'm totally for Social Security and Medicare, but I'm against government.
Then how can you call yourself a right winger?
No, because government health care is bad. Hold on a second. No right wing.
If you lived in Germany, did you ever get sick when you were there, or were you very young?
I lived in Greece. I lived in Greece.
Okay.
I got sick over there, and if I would have went to a public hospital, I would have died.
Well, Greece very best example, and still isn't to this day.
Rich people
in Greece basically don't pay taxes because Greece has got a fairly corrupt political system. But that's no hit on democratic socialism. That's a hit on Greece.
No, that's not a hit on Greece because you go all over Europe, it's the same.
No, it's
you're
not.
You're looking at the best. Germany is the cream of the crop as far as a socialist system, economical system.
Well, actually, I'd say the Scandinavian countries are a whole lot better than Germany.
All right, maybe
Norway, Finland, Denmark, Sweden.
I'll give you that. Scandinavia is one step higher than Germany. But you go to France, Italy, Spain, Ireland.
France has one of the best healthcare systems in the world. They have the best
France
outcomes, and they have the top five outcomes in the world. They're way ahead of us.
France is going private on medical. They're going private now. You know, up to 40% to turn back.
Only for secondary insurance. Primary insurance, it's illegal to make it private.
Because you know, in Europe, if you don't give money under the table to take care of you, they don't take care of you.
No, that's not. Come. Did you ever have to pay money under the table, Dino? Seriously.
Yes.
Where? In Greece?
Where the guy always stack a Bible.
In Greece?
I had an employee. This guy was begging me. His wife.
No, I asked if you ever had to.
I gave him the money to pay it. Yes.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, you're a good guy, Dino, and I still can't figure out why you're a right winger. Thanks a lot for the an extremist for that matter. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Amazing. You know, what makes a right winger? For that matter, how does Mitt Romney try and turn himself into one successfully? I don't think he can pull it off.
Mama, Jamaica. Ooh, I want to take you to Bermuda, Bahama.
That's a Muppet song? Muppet's version. Oh, okay, great. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base on Earth, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network and DirecTV cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. And very pleased to be back with you. Oh, man. Nick in Los Angeles. Hey, Nick, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just have to respond to your last caller.
Mm-hmm.
As a United States citizen and also a U.K. citizen, because I grew up and was born there and moved here a number of years ago,
mm-hmm.
I've been the beneficiary of the national health care system half of my life and have had serious surgery through that system, as have my working-class parents and family. And people don't know what they're talking about when they criticize that system because it's one of the best in the world, even though it's underfunded and abused through poor management and bureaucracy. But the system works, and if it wasn't for that system, my parents and myself, my father's had triple bypass surgery, some of the best surgery in the world. Didn't cost him a penny because he paid for it in his taxes, but he never had to worry about going bankrupt over health care costs or anything like that, and
yep.
The same could be said for his children, myself and my two brothers.
Yep.
So, and they have both alternatives. So people mustn't forget. You know, they also have privatized medicine. If you can afford
sure.
it, you can buy it. But most people can't. And parents could, and most families in the UK would never survive without the national.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. This is why we need a national Medicare for all. And then, you know, if somebody wants to add plastic surgery to what's available from their health insurance, they could buy that. If they want to add, you know, stomach bypass surgery that's not medically necessary, I mean, typically it probably is. Maybe that's a bad example, but you get it. If they want to add on, or if they want to add the ability to get, you know, 4-star catered meals in a private suite in the hotel, they could add, or in the hospital, they can add that into they can buy private add-on insurance. But Democrats, I mean, this is what I don't get about the right-wingers. You go through this list. And tip the hat to John, who sent this along to me. Democrats, of course, brought us this is the opposite of this would be the right-wing extremist, the guy who called and said he's a right-wing extremist. So he must be opposed to all of these things. Democrats brought us Social Security. That was FDR, Medicare, LBJ, Medicaid, LBJ, welfare benefits, FDR, civil rights, LBJ, unemployment insurance, FDR, Labor Relations Board, National Labor Relations Board, FDR. The eight-hour work week, the five-day work week, that was during FDR, fought for workers' compensation. That was Woodrow Wilson. Fought for Americans with the Disability Act. That was the Democratic Congress over a veto by George Herbert Walker Bush. But it still got through. They overrode his veto. For a paid holiday, holiday pay, that was under FDR. Bill Clinton, the Medical Leave Act. Prevention of Child Labor, FDR. The Minimum Wage Act, FDR. Democrats fought for workplace safety. This was actually during the Nixon administration, but Democrats in Congress pushed it through. Democrats fought for affirmative action. This was during the John Kennedy administration. They fought for women's rights during the LBJ administration that was passed. And back in 1920, Democrats fought for tax fairness. That would have been the Wilson administration. Fought for tax fairness, a platform issue. Fought for Veterans Day and, pay and benefits. They fought for consumer protection laws. This was during the Kennedy administration. Gun laws and background checks on weapons. This was both LBJ and Clinton. The Credit Card Holders Bill of Rights under Barack Obama. Funding for our schools, public schools, Lyndon Johnson. Grants for low-income people to attend college, LBJ. And, of course, the GI Bill, that was FDR. The Clean Water and Clean Air Act. This was Democrats who overrode a veto by Richard Nixon to create the EPA. Democrats fought for financial regulation of Wall Street accountable. That's under the Obama administration, Dodd-Frank. The Affordable Care Act, Obama. The hate crime legislation, Obama. This is based on the Matthew Shepard case. For children's health legislation for over 11 million children without health care. This is under Obama. For a national voter registration, Bill Clinton. Voting Rights Act, LBJ. Largest deficit cut in history, Bill Clinton. Largest working class tax cut in history, that was Barack Obama. The Clinton Antitrust Act, Woodrow Wilson. Securities and Exchange Commission, FDR. The National School Lunch Program, Harry Truman. I mean, what have the Republicans accomplished in the last 70 years? I can't think of anything. Seriously, Nick. I mean, I throw this challenge out to my listeners. Can you think of anything that the Republicans have done? Nick, thanks a lot for the call and for giving us a UK perspective on this. I do truly appreciate it. I thought this was an interesting one. Peter in Chapel Hill, Texas, watches us on Free Speech TV. Hey, Peter, what's up? You wanted to talk about Phil Graham.
No, your comment about it started with Wendy Graham.
Yeah, in 92.
My premise is it started with the revolution.
The American Revolution.
We've always been a nation of hustlers.
Oh, okay. You're using Morris Berman's argument.
I've read his book.
Yeah, yeah. I've read his book, too. And, in fact, I had him on for a half-hour conversation. You can see it over at conversationsatthegreatminds.com. And Morris is like such a cynic and such a skeptic and so depressed that he actually left the United States. You know, he lives in Mexico now. He said, that's it. I'm out of here. Although he spends about a third of the year in the United States hawking his books. So who's the hustler?
Well, you hawk books too, Tom.
Yeah, but you know, I'll own up to the fact that I wrote books and I promote them. I don't see why that makes me bad or makes America bad.
I don't see why that makes Morris bad if he's pulling the blinders off.
I don't either, but, you know, if he says, you know, we're a bad country because we're a nation of hustlers, we're a nation of entrepreneurs, we're a nation of people who do things, we're a nation of inventors, we're the nation that brought you Thomas Edison, we're the nation that brought you radio and television and transistors and vacuum tubes, and, we, you know, we're the nation that built the railroads, we're the nation that built the cars, created the auto industry, we're that nation. We're the nation that put the man on the moon. I mean, in Morris Berman's world, all those things make us hustlers. In my world, all those things make us pretty cool.
Yeah, you're, buy away, shop till you drop.
Well, I'm not suggesting that. His critique of American consumer culture, I agree with.
It was also Tocqueville's critique, Thoreau's critique, Melville, Poe, Henry Adams.
You know, I would submit that if you think that was de Tocqueville's critique of the United States in 1836 when he came over here and this young French nobleman came over here and spent 6 months traveling around the central eastern United States, that you haven't read Democracy in America.
He said all he talked about was money.
No, have you ever read Democracy in America?
De Tocqueville's book?
I'm betting you haven't.
Yes.
Because if you...
Yes, I have.
Well, where in... You know,
he said all he ever heard Americans talking about was money.
No, he didn't say that. Or he may have said that in passing somewhere in the book. But, you know, in fact, chapter 11, I think it's chapter 11. I thought it was the most brilliant chapter in the entire book. I quoted from it rather extensively in my book, Unequal Protection, where he was talking about what do Americans have to fear. And he said he sees a time in the distant future when Americans will be seduced by a what he called a vast tutelary power, a teaching power that just kind of overwhelms Americans, that will shape their opinions and mold them in the way that it wants them to go.
Americans have no opinions.
I think he was predicting the modern aggregation of the television networks and this giant, you know, these giant media corporations, frankly. But Henry Thoreau, yeah, he was not a big fan of consumer culture, but he didn't like paying his taxes. Went off to live in Walden Pond, but he was about spirituality. He was one of the transcendentalists, him and Emerson. So anyway, Peter, I agree with the critique of consumer culture that Morris Berman put forward, but I don't think that we're a nation of hustlers. And thank you for the call. I think that we're I do think that this started with Wendy Graham being appointed by Ronald Reagan. In fact, I have registered the websites. It all started with Reagan.com. It all began with Reagan.com. Louise says that's going to be on my tombstone. It all started with Reagan. Alvin in Greeley, Colorado. Hey, Alvin, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. The reason I'm calling is you're talking about the Enron scandal, and you remember how after that happened, President Bush signed into new accounting rule laws. And I just read an article last week that Mitt Romney wants to repeal those laws.
He and all the Republicans that were talking about repeal Dodd-Frank, you know, it's like this is the mantra, and this is what you've got to do if you want to get Wall Street billionaires to give you a lot of money. That's what's going on, Alvin. Thank you very much for the call. Max in Portland listening on KPOJ. Hey, Max, we got a minute to the break. Quick.
Okay, I just wanted to let you know I grew up in New Jersey, and I've seen people like Dino and talked with them many years, and my uncle used to describe them as BSers who talk too much. And you will never convince them.
Let's not pick on Dino. Did you ever live in Germany or Europe?
I live in Germany right now. He's wrong about the healthcare system.
You live in Germany right now. So you're visiting Portland?
I'm here on business.
Yeah. Okay. And he's wrong about the health. The modern German healthcare system works.
It works for me. It works for everyone I know. They shake their heads when I try to explain how it works in America. They don't understand how it can be so silly.
That's been my experience as well. I haven't used their healthcare system since the 80s, but I get back there every year. And, in fact, in about 2 weeks, we're going to be doing this show live for 3 days from Germany. And we'll be talking to Germans about their healthcare system and about their taxes and everything else. We'll see what they have to say about it. But, Max, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to KPOJ. We'll be back 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This whole long list of things that I just read you that Democrats have brought to the United States, what have Republicans brought us? Can anybody come up with one thing? Just one?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Actually, I can come up with something Republicans have brought us. Ronald Reagan tripled the national debt. Oh, yeah, but that's not a good thing, is it? Oh, well.
Someday we'll find it. The rainbow connection, the lovers, the dreamers, and me.
Oh, we're all Muppets now. Goldman Sachs said so, after all, you know, and you got to squeeze all the cash out of them Muppets you can, right? Because that's what making money's all about. The op-ed is on the front page of today's New York Times, or at least on the front page of their website. I'm guessing it's, I haven't read the physical newspaper today. Since we moved on to the boat, they don't make deliveries down there. So I had to give up my New York Times and Financial Times subscriptions and just go online. Tyler in Northampton, Mass, listening on 96.9 FM. Hey, Tyler, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What's on your mind?
So I just wanted to say I'm glad that I'm not the only one who sees this sort of overt, it's not even a covert, platform anymore. The overt sort of agenda of the Republican Party is, you know, the utter deregulation of business. And I think that really, you know, just sums up the
take us back to the 19th century. That's all they have to offer. Let's go back to the 19th century. Let's go back to the Gilded Age. And I've had people like Yaron Brook come on this program, the head of the Ayn Rand Institute, and say, you know, the Gilded Age is pretty good. You know, a lot of billionaires became billionaires then. And
I'm glad that you mentioned Ayn Rand too, because if you take this person, you know, Ayn Rand's two main philosophies, contributions, is rational self-interest and laissez-faire capitalism. And
right.
You mix those two things together and you get a crazy dystopia of, you know, unregulated business.
And you get the crash of 2008, as Alan Greenspan in a
Absolutely.
Moment of weakness confessed before Congress. Thank you very much, Tyler. Well said. Appreciate the call. Al in Buffalo, New York, watching us on Free Speech TV. Al, what's on your mind?
Tom, I got to say, okay, so anyways, Tom, the Republicans blew the banks, which caused the worst economic crash since the Great Depression, okay?
Right.
They stacked the courts with political hacks while liberals were arguing amongst each other and voting for Republicans, by the way, which led to the Citizens United. Justice Clarence Thomas received, and his wife, what was it, $1.6 million, $700,000 from the Heritage
Foundation. Yeah, it was mostly his wife. I think he got some speaking fees. But, you know, Al, it sounds like you're reading something. What's your point?
I have to read this because it's very important. This man should be removed from the bench, okay?
Yeah, I agree. Clarence Thomas has violated the Judicial Code of Ethics, and so has, in my opinion, John Roberts.
You need to have a little more passion in your voice, sir. I'm sorry, but we need to get the Congress to act now. This man has to get removed.
Okay, I got it, Al. I got it. And I appreciate the passion in your voice. Thank you very much for that. John in Stockton, California. Hey, John, what's up?
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I called mainly because I've got something I'd really like to. I wish I was talking to you personally and not on the air.
You are.
But I have a. Okay. Oh, I am good.
Yeah, this is me.
I mean, I'm not on the air though, right?
Yeah, you are. Yes. So please,
okay.
No obscenities.
no, I'm just. I feel like I'm advertising for myself, but I don't want to. But I've got a song on YouTube because I heard you say YouTube.
Yeah.
I've got a song on YouTube that I wrote called The American Flag.
The American Flag, F-L-A-G.
Yeah, F-L-A-G.
Okay.
My name is John Tiano, and I wrote this song many years ago. I wrote it when the Giants and the A's were in the World Series together, the first game, right?
Yeah.
It inspired me to write the song, and the song is so poignant for what's happening in the world right
well,
now.
Yeah, that's absolutely great, John, and people can go over to YouTube and check it out. Thanks for letting us know about it. I appreciate the plug. Sean in Shreveport, Louisiana, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I'm Sean, and I'm from Louisiana, and you were talking to a conservative before, and you wanted to know something that he could tell you that made him a conservative. Well,
right.
I'm a conservative, and I'd like to answer your question.
Thank you.
I've got some things to say, and if you let me.
Oh, we've got about 2 minutes here before the end of the show, so let's do it.
Okay. First of all, smaller government.
Why?
Federal government is much too large.
Why?
It tries to do too many. Why? I'm trying to tell you. It tries to do too many things.
No, wait a minute. What's your objective evidence of that, Sean? Our government represents 21% of our GDP. Canada's government represents 54% of their GDP. Why is it that Canadians have a better quality of life than we do and they're happier with their government?
As soon as government takes over health care, it'll represent 60% of GDP.
No, it'll represent about 35 or 40% with health care.
No, that's not true.
Okay, it is.
No, it's not. You also said
healthcare right now is 16% of our GDP. That's with private
right.
corporate healthcare. If you strip the profit margins out of that and the $1 billion and multi-million dollar salaries
out of it.
You can. You do away with health insurance companies. And if
cost.
You do that, you're going to shave about 1% off. So healthcare is going to be about 15% of the economy. So
and
if the government took over healthcare,
twice,
we would go from 21% of the economy to 36% of the economy. Simple math. Look it up.
Anything the government does is going to cost three times as much as it's done in the private.
Give me one example. Arizona tried
Medicare,
to turn their prisons over
Medicare,
to private corporations. They're taking them back now because the private corporations have to make money. Government doesn't have to make money. Government can operate lean and mean. Private corporations don't.
And they overpay their employees.
No, they don't. Private corporations underpay their employees. You know, until Ronald Reagan came into office, government workers consistently, throughout the history of the United States, made less than people in the private sector. Now they make more. Why is that?
Almost double.
Do you know why that is?
Under Obama, if you don't want an answer, then you shouldn't ask me to call.
Why is it, in your mind, Sean, why is it that government workers always made less than the private sector And now, well, actually, they don't make more. If you look at the same job, you look at a rocket scientist working for NASA versus a rocket scientist working in the private sector. You look at a physician working for the U.S. government versus a physician in the private sector. At the above $100,000, people always make less when they work for the government.
Working for the U.S. government as a manager, working in the private sector, he makes 2 to 3 times as much. And there's a lot more managers in the government.
No.
There's a lot more managers in the government.
Sean, you got your numbers wrong, A, and B.
No, I don't have my numbers wrong.
And B, what we have seen is with the erosion as unionization in the public sector has gone from 25% down to 8%.
No, you're wrong. And you also asked me you said that it was good that India is taking over the manufacturing this bill and not going to give Bayer and not have Bayer do it, and it's going to cost them more. Well, I'll tell you what.
They're paying Bayer 6%.
If they're paying Bayer 6%, that won't cover Bayer R&D. And if Bayer doesn't make money, Bayer won't produce medicine. If they don't produce medicine, people are going to die.
Yeah.
Okay?
Right. That is a strong argument for patent law, and we should have that debate sometime. But how long should their patent hold?
Have you ever worked for a poor man?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, and I started several businesses as a poor man.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So right now, every American has, throughout their life, from birth to death, has an insurance policy that for the average 25-year-old is worth about $2 million. If they become disabled, they get in a car accident and break their back or their neck or something, if something, you know, horrible were to happen to you, if the breadwinner of the family dies and the children are left with no source of income, there is a $1 to $2 million insurance policy that will protect you for the rest of your life. It's called Social Security. What I just described represents about a third of all the payments coming out of Social Security. Additionally, it's got $2.6 trillion in its trust fund right now, and it would be solvent for the next 25 years. And if we simply lifted the cap, people making over $106,000 a year don't pay anything into Social Security after that after the tax on that $106,000. After that, you know, Bill Gates pays nothing into it, Warren Buffett pays nothing into it, the banksters on Wall Street pay nothing into it. So if we simply lifted that cap, Social Security would be solvent forever. As it is, 25 years from now, it'll pay out 80% of benefits. So what do we do about that? There's a lot of people running around saying, oh, I've got a solution. Peter Ferrara is one of them. He's a lawyer, policy analyst, senior fellow with the Carlson Center for Public Policy. The website is theccpp.org, as in Carlson Center for Public Policy. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
So you have a way to solve the problem, I guess, is the word that you would use. I think it's the Social Security shortfall that's going to happen 25 years from now.
Well, Paul Ryan introduced a bill that I helped him write in 2004, providing an option for all workers to choose a personal account option for Social Security. He reintroduced the bill in 2005. Those were scored both times by the chief actuary of Social Security as achieving full solvency for Social Security without cutting benefits or raising taxes. Then he concluded that the personal accounts were so obviously a better deal that 100% of workers would choose the personal accounts. That's backed up by the real-world experience of Chile, where they allowed workers the freedom of choice, and almost 100% of workers did choose that.
Peter, wait a second. First of all, in Chile, it was the dictator, the military dictator, Augusto Pinochet, who killed off the Social Security system because he thought it was socialist and replaced it with a bankster-driven system. And that system now, because the banksters charge fees, in some years people make negative 3%, negative 5%. Michelle Bachelet, the new president of Chile, allowed people recreated the publicly funded Social Security system, and people are flocking to it in droves. How can you call this? I mean, this was neoliberalism at its worst when the dictator said to people, sorry, no more Social Security. Of course, 100% of the people, you know, went for the private plans. There was nothing else.
None of that is true. That's you're reading from a fairy tale bedtime story. They had the choice of staying in the old plan or the new plan. 97% of workers chose the new plan.
No.
Those scores by the chief actuary of Social Security are still available on his website. www.ssa.gov. He scored another bill introduced last September.
Okay, this was for retirement benefits, right?
For Social Security.
This is for retirement benefits. How are you going to pay for the one third of payments that Social Security pays out to people who might be, you know, a 25-year-old who's listening right now who, God forbid, gets in a car accident and finds that they have to spend the rest of their life in bed or in a wheelchair?
What they have in Chile is private disability insurance that provides disability benefits, private life insurance that provides the survivor's benefits, and those are higher.
We had all of that here in the United States before 1935, Peter. We had all of it.
Yeah,
E.F. Stone made a fortune in the 1900s building an insurance company.
Let's just make this simple, Tom, and you're trying to choose between your lies and my facts. Just let each worker choose.
Lies?
Just throw it over and open and let them, each worker, make the choice like they did in Chile. And maybe you're afraid that the chief actor of Social Security is right and 100%.
Peter, tell me. Hang on just a second. First of all, I'm frankly offended by being called a liar. I think that's pretty offensive.
Your entire show from the beginning to end is a fairy tale and a lie. You make
Peter, these are not lies. Anybody can look this stuff up. Social Security is solvent. Social Security is sitting on $2.6 trillion. Social Security will do just, and if you raise the cap, it would do great. And we did have what you're suggesting before 1935, and people were dying in their old age.
What you just said is a perfect example of how false everything you say is. You said they have $2.6 trillion. The total amount of money Social Security has, I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's 0.00. They have 0.00. What's in the so-called Social Security Trust Fund are not assets. There are no assets in the trust fund. Those are our liabilities.
Treasury bills.
The federal taxpayers.
They're treasury bills. So when George W. Bush was born, Peter, you're saying that the millions of dollars in his trust fund when he was born that were in treasuries, that the Bush family had invested in nice, safe government treasuries, that wasn't real money?
All the money in the Social Security Trust Fund, supposed money, are actually recognized in federal accounting as part of the national debt. They are not assets.
All treasuries are.
Taxpayers.
If you buy a $1,000 treasury bill, it's part of the federal debt. So what?
The reason you keep interrupting me is because you're wrong, and that's you need to.
No, I keep interrupting you, Peter, because you put out things that aren't right, and when you can't win a battle without personal attacks, that's pretty pathetic, Peter. I'm sorry, pathetic is a personal attack. I take it back.
You have not let me finish a sentence without interrupting me. So I.
Well, it's because you're trying to filibuster me. It's not a sentence; it's a paragraph that I've interrupted.
I haven't finished a sentence yet.
Okay, finish a sentence.
You spend most of the 10 minutes we have on the introduction. You do that every time I'm on your show.
Finish a sentence.
How am I filibustering you? You've got a whole 3 hours there, and you can't allow me 10 minutes to talk.
Finish
so
a sentence.
The official U.S. government recognizes that you're wrong because they recognize the Social Security Trust Fund as part of the national debt, subject to the debt limit, not as assets of the federal government.
But I have to interrupt you. That's because the Social Security Trust Fund has the money, the surplus money that they have. They have a choice. Where do we invest this? Do we give it to Goldman Sachs, who's going to screw us, or do we put it into treasury bills? And they put it into treasury bills, which is what I think we all want.
It's not invested in treasury bills, Tom. It's spent. The money's taken and spent.
It is invested in treasury bills, Peter.
No, Tom, that's actually wrong. It's a statement of the legal authority.
Peter, go.
Tom, let me explain it to you. You don't know. I'm a lawyer. I know what the law says. It's a statement of the legal authority that Social Security has to draw from general revenues. There are $0 in the Social Security Trust Fund. It's just a statement of legal authority that Social Security
Peter,
has
go,
to draw
go,
from
if you,
revenues.
If you go
that's
to the
U.S. government statement, is, don't tell me where to go. I
go
know
to the,
where
go
to go.
The New York Times or go to any. I'm not telling.
Go to the New York Times, Tom.
Go to the New York Stock Exchange, Peter, and type in TLT. TLT is an exchange traded fund of U.S. federal treasuries, and you know there's a lot of people buying these. This is a way that you can buy treasury bills, and you can buy them in $15-$20 increments, whatever TLT is selling for these days. And a lot of people invest in it because it doesn't go crazy when the markets go crazy. It's a way of buying treasuries without having to buy them directly from the federal government. Are you saying that the people who run that bond fund are just scamming all of their customers because the treasury bills and bonds are worthless?
Social Security does not go out in the market and buy treasury bills or treasury bonds.
No, they have a unique type just for themselves.
Let me explain it to you, Tom. They would be investing if they did that, but that's not what they do. Instead, they give the money to the federal government for specially issued new treasury bonds, and that money is then spent. So all the money that you claim in the Social Security Trust Fund has all been spent.
It
all they have is an accounting formation.
Peter, if you buy $1,000 worth of Treasury bonds,
well, that's not what Social Security
that,
does.
That Social money, Security when you give that $1,000 to the federal government, it gets spent. Okay, when you turn that $1,000 bond in, you get the money back.
I've explained to you already that that's not the way the Social Security program works. They do not go out in the market.
Then how is it that the Social Security fund right this minute is liquidating bonds and using them to pay benefits? They're doing it as we speak.
If they went out in the market and bought Treasury bonds, that would be investing in Treasury bonds.
No, that would be giving money to Goldman Sachs.
That would be investing in Treasury bonds. That's not what how the Social Security thing operates. Social Security transfers the so-called surplus, which they no longer have, but what they did was they transferred the surplus to the federal government in return for issuing a new bond, which the federal government then spent. So that is not an investment transaction. That is a spending transaction, and that's how the federal accounting accounts for it as part of the national debt, not as an asset. There's nothing in the Social Security trust funds to sell. They could turn it back into the federal government
except
from the taxpayers, which is double payment because the tax then coming out of the income tax as well as the payroll tax. But
Peter, I finally have to interrupt you. Peter Ferrara, theccpp.org. Check it out.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you very much for being with us today. As always, a pleasure. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Steve, listening on KPHX in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Steve, you want to challenge me on this, eh?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm watching on Free Speech, Tom.
Oh, my apologies. Okay, so what's up?
I wanted to speak about the health care, what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And, I live in the retirement community here. And I've had the experience of talking to the Canadians here who are snowbirds who have second homes down here.
Mm-hmm.
And over the years, I've talked to 20 to 25 of them. And I had the opportunity to talk to a granddaughter who is an oncologist in the oncology unit in Canada. And I asked her a little bit about it. And she says, the treatment, how soon it would be if you needed treatment. She told me, she says, if you come in and you're diagnosed with cancer, let's say on a Tuesday, she says, by Thursday, you're in for chemo. So it's a fallacy that there's a big delay
in Canada.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
And this is from the horse's mouth, an oncologist.
Yeah.
On the other hand,
if you go into a physician's office in Canada and say, my hip is aching a little bit, I think I need a hip replacement, they're going to say, get in line, it may take 6 months. But I can tell you that, a family member of mine was recently diagnosed with something that might be cancer, and the earliest appointment that he could get was several weeks down the road from anybody, any kind of specialist. And that's in the United States with insurance, right? Whereas in Canada, it would, as you say, it would be the next day, it would be that same week. And in Germany, I know you can walk in off the street and say, I'm here, and the doctor will say, fine, what do you want?
Exactly.
I mean, it's just amazing. We have such a screwed up system. Thank you very much for the call. V in Atlanta, listening on Sirius. Hey, V, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? I'm an ex-Air Force,
mm-hmm.
4-year veteran, and my father is in the hospital now. He's been a 10-year survivor of cancer, and if it wasn't for him being in the military, he's ex-Air Force, I don't know what our family would have done.
Yeah, and the military is the most socialist institution in the United States. It's an institution that provides for your housing, it provides for your food, it provides for your health care, it even provides clothing. And, I mean, it doesn't get more socialist than that.
They do a lot.
And it works pretty well.
A marvelous and wonderful institution, and their medical staff are excellent.
Yeah, and wouldn't it be great if everybody in America, I don't know about the housing and food part of it and clothes part of it, but if everybody in America had the same kind of health care available to them, no questions asked, no bills to pay, as people do in the military. Yeah, it would. You're absolutely right.
I'm making the bottom line for my nieces to get in the military and get their education.
Yeah.
They also help provide school and college.
Yeah.
I'm calling about, I like the fact that you do your homework. I'm a first-time caller, and I listen to your show quite often. And when you present the facts to these individuals, you know, be on the left or the right. You know, it's not a one-sided conversation. If they're quoting wrong situations or wrong statements, then it is your duty, because it's your show, to say, hey, this is wrong information.
I know, it's okay to interrupt people.
This wrong information on my show.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Social Security is not the problem. And they know it. Like any fine item that needs calibration, I used to be a jet engine mechanic. You know, it has a time check, quality control would say, hey, the time check's coming up, you know, recalibrate it, recheck it.
Yep.
You know, all Social Security needs is tweaking, and it'll be fine. That's not the problem. And they know this.
But it's a Democratic program. This is the problem. It was introduced by Democrats. And the Republicans hate this. And not only that, Social Security is sitting on $2.5 trillion. And can you imagine the amount of money that Goldman Sachs could make?
Hands on that money.
That's right. Goldman Sachs could make a fortune.
Bent over backwards to get their hands on that money.
You are absolutely right. V, I got to move along. But thank you very much for your call. I appreciate it. Very insightful. Grace in Los Gatos, California. Hey, Grace, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hey, how you doing? I just wanted to make a couple of points on Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans are always saying that they want to turn it into a personal savings account.
Yeah.
But we already have a personal savings account because it's called Social Security.
There you go. you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Thank you for pointing that out, Grace. And we also all have the ability to buy if you've got the money, you can invest it, you know, with Fidelity or, you know, I forget the names of all these investment companies, but whatever. You can Goldman Sachs, right? If you want, you can give them your money and they'll gladly take it and tell you that they're going to get. So anyhow, Grace, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. And, let's see here. Mary in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hey, Mary, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just wanted to make a comment on that guy that called and said how much money public employees make.
Mm-hmm.
I've been working in private industry and I've worked in government. And when you compare the management of the private industry versus and the bonuses and the CEO salaries, the top person at the public health department in the city of St. Paul makes about $120,000 a year. And Tom, you can fill in the blank on this one. How much did the CEO of United Health make?
Yeah, it's over. Well, it's a couple hundred million dollars a year.
Yeah.
Or so over $100 million a year.
And then you've got your bonuses, you've got your country club memberships, so you've got, you know, I know one guy who's a manager, he gets a Home Depot account, he can go there and buy stuff.
Yeah.
He gets his gas paid for, he gets his parking paid for.
Look at the CEO of ExxonMobil, Lee Raymond. When he retired, he was given a $400 million retirement bonus. $400 million. Oh, you're leaving? Here, let me give you $400 million. What? As a retirement?
Same thing with Control Data. When I worked there, the guy got, well, he got only $5 million, but we didn't get an increase that year because he got this $5 million.
Right, worker bees got nothing.
The average worker in public employees make 5% more, maybe 1% more, but the management is just out of this world.
Yeah, I'm with you.
The bonuses themselves. All right, thanks.
Okay. Mary, thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to us there in St. Paul. We'll be back. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Whew. What are we going to do about Social Security? How about just lifting the cap? This is so simple. You know, President Obama proposed this. Republicans in the Senate, he said, in fact, let's just lift the cap on people who make more than $250,000 a year. So there's a donut hole between $106,000 and $250,000. You don't even pay Social Security taxes.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Republicans wouldn't go along with that because it would have hit the multimillionaires and the billionaires. Can't have them have any skin in the game here. They shouldn't pay their fair share. They want to get my gold. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option. Get active. Lou in Eureka, California. Hey, Lou, what's up?
Hey, Tom, check me out on something, will you?
Sure.
I may not be the smartest guy in the world. I do heavy equipment type operations, so I'm not politically astute like a lot of your callers are. But help me piece something together real quick. If I look back in history where I see, you know, they built the pyramids and the Great Wall of China and all the cathedrals, and then you zip it forward in time and all the projects that get built and rich people finance. I never seen one of them damn guys down there in a trench with a shovel. So who the hell needs who here?
Yeah, I think that's a very good statement.
Yeah. Who needs who? They can get down there and help us build this stuff.
Yep.
My second question to you is, and the guys that I work with, they're all for the Republicans because they're going to get their taxes cut 10% is what they're telling me.
Oh, really?
I got to figure that if I get a 10% tax break on my paycheck every 2 weeks, these guys are going to raise their prices. I'm going to give them my 10% rebate. They're going to get their tax cut and mine too.
Yeah, what happens?
First,
and you can
see. I want you to answer.
Well,
I'll take my answer on the air real quick.
Okay.
Would be, I want everybody to know because I looked this up online, and in Massachusetts, it was illegal to buy a condom in that state. 1965, they finally took the laws off of it. It was illegal to buy a condom.
Right. The Supreme Court in something versus Connecticut, Griswold versus Connecticut, I think was the case.
That's pretty bad.
That's right. I'm with you. Now, Lou, let me just answer the second point. What you see is that, first of all, if they think that Republicans are going to cut their taxes, they should look at what happened under the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan doubled the taxes on working people. He passed the biggest tax increase on people making under $60,000 a year in the history of the United States. He also radically cut the taxes on millionaires and billionaires, cut them from 74% down to 28%. So that's the Republican agenda, number one. So number two, you're absolutely right. If you look at history, what you will see is that when taxes on working people go up, wages go up because people are basically the contract that they enter into with their employers is all about the marketplace of labor is all about what people take home. It's about take home pay. And so, you know, if somebody's making $20,000 a year, or let's say $30,000 a year, but they're taking home $20,000 because there's $10,000 in taxes, and obviously that wouldn't be a real number. It would have to be higher than that. But just for purposes of example, they're really working for $20,000. They know it. Their employer knows it. So if the government comes along and says, okay, we're going to cut your taxes in half, and so now you're going to take home, instead of $20,000, you're going to take home $25,000, their employer's going to say, hey, wait a minute, I know this guy would do this job for $20,000. They're going to slowly cut the wages. On the other hand, if the government comes along and says, you know, we're going to double your taxes, instead of paying $10,000 in taxes, you're going to have to pay $20,000. Now their take-home pay went from 20 to 10. They're going to say, I'm not going to work for $10,000 anymore. The employer knows that. The employer is going to raise their pay. Over time, take-home pay basically remains stable. And taxes just kind of bounce around the margins. And the proof of this is that after Reagan's tax increase on working people, we saw wages go up. And everybody points, all the Republicans say, oh, look at that, Ronald Reagan, he helped wages go up. Well, yeah, he did, by increasing taxes on working people. And then Bill Clinton cut taxes on working people and wages went down. I mean, it's got nothing to do with tax policy. It's got to do with the relationship between workers in the workplace and employers. So, Lou, you are very politically astute. You put your finger on all three of them, but you nailed it perfectly. Thank you very much for the call. Well done. Calvin in Birmingham, Alabama. Hey, Calvin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
Glad to finally talk to you, man. I've been listening to you forever.
Well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Two questions. If your guest says that the Social Security is broke, what is he talking about privatizing if there's no money there?
Oh, that's a damn good question. You are way ahead of me, Calvin. I should have.
Yeah, I was about to pull my hat out when you were sitting there saying, let's
that's for the next debate. Money. Okay, if they're broke, then why do you want their money? That's great.
And another thing is, what would they have to invest if we stopped buying their product? All of these corporations who want all of these tax cuts.
Right.
That's why I love Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah,
she's dead on when she says that all the time.
Yep, I'm totally with you. And the only problem there, I mean, there's a big debate here in Washington D.C. right now. There's six Walmarts fixing to move into town, and a lot of people are very concerned about that because there are a lot of small family-owned businesses still left in Washington D.C. and they're afraid that they're all going to get wiped out, and they probably will, and rightfully so. So you know, this is part of the problem is that because Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act in '82. You have seen since the early 80s this explosion of giant retail companies, and not just retail, I mean every industry that there is, but you know, I'm speaking of retail here. You've seen this explosion of retail industries to the point where small entrepreneurial businesses, if somebody decides that they want to start a dry cleaning shop or they want to start a restaurant or they want to start, you know, fill in the blank, they want to start a clothing shop, a furniture store, you can't do it anymore because you can't compete with these giant chains, and you especially can't compete with Walmart. They will put you out of business.
Exactly.
And that,
then, you know,
go ahead.
The government increase on the fees, and that's the way Reagan got us. By increasing the fees on everything that we bought, our license, our fishing license, hunting license, and they don't even realize that is a tax.
Yeah.
It's coming out of our pocket, and it's a tax.
Yeah, I agree with you. And
I don't get it.
This is one of the ways that they, we're going to cut your income tax, but it's going to cost you twice as much to register your car.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, there you go. Okay,
thanks
a lot, Calvin. Good to hear from you. Mary in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Oh, it's a beautiful day here in the 80s.
Oh,
but
great.
I have a comment
it is here in D.C. too.
We were talking about,
It is here in D.C. too, but go ahead with your comment.
Is it? The comment about military health care. Yeah, it's great for the active duty member, especially if you are close to a military base. But when you are the dependents of the military member and you're not near a military base,
then you got a problem.
It really isn't. You've got a big problem.
Yeah.
Here in Raleigh, we only have a couple providers for all of the military personnel in this area to choose from. Most of them, I wouldn't choose to take my two dogs to.
Yeah. I'm sorry to hear that, Mary.
One does unauthorized AIDS tests on non-risk individuals to bill. Another one doesn't speak any English. Not that there's a problem with foreigners in jobs, but
speaking English is a good thing
forms.
If you're a doc.
Well, especially for medical.
Yeah, Mary. It seems to me that there's two competing problems here. One is that the military has unique healthcare problems in that people who have, you know, limbs amputated or, you know, a lot of injuries that are sustained in the military typically don't happen in the civilian world. Or our rarities.
Correct.
And so the military does need specialized medical facilities. And on the other hand, having those specialized military facilities for people who are not active service, and you're right, if you're not on a military base or near one where there's excellent service and you've just decided in your retirement to retire to West Wazoo, Montana or something where there's not a military base, you've got to do some serious traveling to get the nearest VA. What's the solution?
Raleigh, we have to drive to Chapel Hill.
Right. I had once thought that what we should seriously consider doing is merging at least part of the military of the VA services with a Medicare Part E kind of system. You know, once everybody in the country is insured, but that wouldn't necessarily cover those special military needs. So I think this is the thing that people have been struggling with for a long, long time in the United States is how do you have a military healthcare service and a civilian healthcare service that both work.
Well, also, if you look at, okay, here in Raleigh, the providers for mental health services, you know there are a lot of discharged vets right now that are having serious mental health issues.
Sure.
There are only a few. And
only a few providers.
They're not getting the things that they need. Yeah, they can go to the VA, but that's also swamped.
Yeah, so we've got to
go out into the civilian world.
Right, so we've got to figure this out. Mary, I thank you very much for the call. And thanks for raising the issue. I don't have a solution to it. I it's something that I know is a problem. Tony in Long Beach, California. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Oh, very good. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I wanted to let you know just quickly. Listening to you and watching you reminds me of the way I felt during the 50s watching Murrow.
Oh, interesting. Thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
I'm honored by the comparison.
Powerful broadcaster. Really quickly, I worry that when Obama, I say when because I want to be optimistic, wins the seat in the office, that it's going to be a huge power struggle between Democratic interests on one side of the aisle and the plutocracy on the other.
Yep. Already is.
And it's not going to stop.
Yep.
What is he going to be able to do, or let's say he and all of his support to combat that?
Well, there's two things to consider. The first is that as a lame duck president, as somebody who's not going to run for re-election, He can do an awful lot that he might not be able to do right now because it would rouse the ire of special interest groups that would take him out in an election. And so I'm actually quite optimistic about a second term. Secondly, it's all about the wind behind your back. You know, Franklin Roosevelt, when he ran for president in 1932, he ran on a policy of balancing the budget and small incremental change. But by the time he came into office, you know, most of the banks had failed in the United States, and he realized he had to do something really big. At that time, he had an overwhelming majority, Democratic majority, in both the House and the Senate. So he was able to get those things done. That's what we need to be doing. We need to be working to get the House and the Senate in strong blue territory. Tony, that's our job. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Coming up next, more of your calls. And we're going to check in with Ellen Ranner with the Talk Radio News Service, freshly back from Antarctica. Find out what's going on in the world. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us, the Tom Hartman Program, and Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com is here, brought to you by her new book, Self-Empowerment, 9 Things the 19th Century Can Teach Us About Living in the 21st. Hey, Ellen.
Okay, well, House, the Senate today, the House is out, passed the $109 billion highway bill, 74-22, clearly quite bipartisan. The pressure is now on Mr. Boehner to get it passed in his chamber.
They got Republicans in the Senate to vote for this
thing.
It's
going
to create jobs.
That's right.
Of course, it's only going to create a few jobs. I mean, we have a $2 trillion infrastructure deficit, and this is a $100 billion. That's 0.05% or 0.5%,
right.
Whatever. But it's a start.
Well, today I did something I don't usually do. I don't usually have the time to go to these conferences, but I did go to the Atlantic Conference on finance today, put on by Atlantic Magazine. And they said a couple things. One, 10,000 people a day are turning 65 years old. People are turning in their 401ks because they need the money. 70% of the Tea Party does not want a change in Medicare. Voters, and there's $500 to $600 billion a year going to help states directly. Now, what's really interesting is that Ed Rendell was perhaps the best speaker of the day, and
the former governor of Pennsylvania.
That's right. He said we need an investment in infrastructure, we need R&D, we need alternative energy strategies, we need human capital education, we have to involve 3-year-olds in reading and socialization, computers in every classroom, spending money to get money. Then Peter Schiff, he's from the Euro-Pacific capital, he's sort of this economist type.
Yeah.
He went after Ben Bernanke like I have never seen anybody do it in my life. He said investors need protection from Ben Bernanke. He said he's repeating Greenspan's mistake to artificially stimulate the economy. He said Bernanke has the economy hooked on cheap credit, and our economy is getting sicker. He said that he called liberal arts degrees worthless.
Yeah. Peter, I've debated Peter Schiff before.
I mean,
he's a pretty hard right wing guy.
Yeah, he's really out there.
And
they didn't have
the
anybody
money.
Really left wing. Their most left wing person they had was Rendell. Now, Paul Volcker also spoke today, and he was pretty out there. He said the only political reform that can happen will be between November and March of next year after the election. He said there is a well financed resistance to any kind of change in this country.
He's right.
He said that income growth at the top has not been so top-heavy since 1929.
He's right.
He said that the challenge of the economy is at odds with electoral realities. And he said, this is, I thought of you when he said this. He said, Goldman Sachs went from a customer-oriented organization to a trading organization.
Did you see this op-ed in the Today's New York Times?
I did. People were referring to that today.
Amazing,
yes.
You know.
And then Bob Rubin got up and spoke. And it was like word salad. I mean, he didn't say anything other than the Eurozone probably is going to have problems. He said nothing in like a half hour.
Well, Bob Rubin was not a good advisor, not a good counselor to President Clinton.
Clearly
we'll just leave it
not.
At that.
All right. Also today, the president had a press conference with the Prime Minister of Britain. Of course, today is the state visit of that. They are saying that they are determined to prevent Tehran from getting a nuclear weapons and that nothing is off the table. That is what Barack Obama said. Also, in terms of Syria, they said it is horrific violence. The focus is on humanitarian aid. They want to increase the pressure and mobilize the international community. They said that they're ready to work with China and Russia. They want the quickest way to stop the killing. They said if Assad continues, civil war is inevitable. They'll work with anybody, but the opposition is getting much stronger and that Assad will leave.
On the other hand, one of the senior opposition leaders just fled. In fact, two of them fled the opposition yesterday. There's signs that it's starting to, there's infighting there, which I think is a tragedy. And the other thing that I don't know if you saw this news story, Ahmadinejad was dragged before the mullahs yesterday or the day before, and they just raked him over the coals for making intemperate statements.
Yes, there is a huge problem there, actually.
Yeah, because the mullahs have said that building a nuclear bomb is anti-Islamic and is a violation of Islamic law, and Iran will never do it. And Ahmadinejad is kind of wink, wink, nod, nod to the rest of the world, like, yeah, we're thinking about it. I mean, he's never said it, but he's kind of behaving like he wants people to believe it. They're quite upset about this.
They are quite upset about it.
And he has no real power as president.
Well, no, I mean, the mullahs have all the power.
Yeah, he's basically
supposedly elected, but yeah. Right. Also, today, Princeton Lyman was before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about South Sudan and Sudan, saying that the Blue Nile and South Kordofan, which is, of course, right, you know, there on the border, mm-hmm. is in danger of grave famine and refugees, and they want to put pressure on China, that has a lot of investments in Sudan, particularly North Sudan, to begin to put pressure on the government to allow aid in there.
So which government is not allowing? Is it the North Sudanese?
It's North Sudanese.
So it's the Bashir.
Yes.
It's Bashir.
Now, Bashir is interestingly enough in South Sudan.
He's in South Sudan today?
Yeah.
With Salva Kiir?
Go figure. Yes.
Well, you know, they've got to split up the oil money.
Right.
And it's like, you know, money makes strange bedfellows, I guess.
It certainly does.
Billions of dollars metered by the Norwegians.
But you know, last year there was a drought, and of course they're starting in on the rainy season, but there's all these refugees all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. It's as you and I have both seen.
Let me just go on to a couple other things that happened today at the situation with Britain, and that is that it is interesting. Prime Minister Cameron said that this financial situation in Britain and the United States is very, very different, that they have very different financial issues and different financial crises going on. And so he said that although the United States and Great Britain are working together, there are other issues. And by the way, today, none other than Leon Panetta is in Afghanistan mm-hmm. today, trying to make nice, given what just happened.
And as soon as his plane landed, a suicide bomber came through the gate.
Well, they've been having big problems, and of course, you know, also in Columbus, Ohio today, there was a knifing at a college, one of those for-profit colleges,
yeah.
I think, or, you know, academic, not academic college, but business
sure.
kind of colleges. And I guess somebody went in with two knives and knifed four people.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry to hear that. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by the new book Self-Empowerment by Ellen Ratner and Ann Gaiman. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So if we regulate bringing prescription drugs to the market, and we do because people used to die before we did that. Why don't we regulate bringing Wall Street derivatives to the market? You think people didn't die as a result of the big crash? You had divorces, you had suicides, you had homicides, you had people thrown out of their homes, people lost their health care, people died because of what the banksters on Wall Street did. We don't trust pharmaceutical companies to make a new drug and immediately put it on the shelves to sell to the American people. We saw them do that 100 years ago, and they killed lots and lots of people, which led to the creation of the Food and Drug Administration to make sure that our drugs are safe before they get to us. We make them jump through all kinds of hoops and wait years to get approval for new medicines. That's because a new drug can crash our bodies. Now, think about it for a minute. You know, is a new untested, hey, here, try this. I got this wonderful new pill for you. You know, in the 19-teens, I believe it was Bayer. Might have been another company, but whatever it was. They came out with a new cough syrup. Specifically for children, or especially for children, but you know, it was directed toward the market of children and ladies. It was called heroin. That was the brand name. That was the cool name that the ad agency came up with, or the ad people within the company, the pharmaceutical company, came up with. Let's call this new. It was a morphine derivative that does do a great job of suppressing coughs. Let's call it heroin. Okay, great. Bring it to market. You know, this is back before the FDA. So if we're going to regulate things that can crash our bodies, what about things that can crash our entire country? Like the derivatives that Reagan's Commodity Futures Trading Commission had Wendy Graham allowed Enron to start inventing back in 1992, 5 weeks before she resigned her post with the government and took multi-million dollar gig as a director of Enron. Why is it that ever since then we've trusted Wall Street to make new exotic financial instruments, any that they want, without any oversight? Think about it for a second. If I'm a drug company and I'm manufacturing a new cancer drug, it's going to take years to prove that drug is safe before it's let loose on the marketplace. Right, first, there's the preclinical phase, in which the drug is tested in laboratories on animals, make sure that the biological effects aren't destructive. That takes about 2 years. If all that goes well, then the drug companies have to apply to the FDA to begin the second phase, which includes testing the new drug on healthy volunteers, see if anybody falls over dead, and what the right dosages should be. That takes another year. About 70% of drugs make it past this phase. About 30% don't. After that, they move on to evaluating the effectiveness of the drug and determining its side effects. That's done by testing patients who need the drug. That takes another 2 years. And only a third of all drugs make it past this phase. 70% fall off the scale. Then is the final phase, which takes another 2 years. The drug is tested on a larger group of patients to verify the effectiveness and look out for any adverse consequences of long-term use of the drug. Only about a quarter of all new drugs make it past this phase. After all that, the drug companies have to file another approval request with the FDA, which then might conduct its own investigation or ask the drug company to run more tests. Overall, this entire process takes between 8 and 12 years, as it should. It's reasonable and rational. You want to know if you're taking a pharmaceutical for the flu that it's not going to kill you with a heart attack. But on Wall Street, it's different. On Wall Street, the banksters get to basically do anything they want. They can come up with any new CDO or credit default swap or some other crazy derivative and immediately start pushing it on their customers, whether it's you and me or Greece or Spain, which they did, by the way. It's one of the reasons why Greece and Spain are in trouble. And there's not one study done on those CDOs or derivatives. There's not one testing phase performed to determine just how risky these new financial products are, not only to investors, but to a nation's economy as a whole. It takes at least 8 years for a new cancer drug to be approved. But there's not even a process anymore since the Reagan-Bush deregulation for a new derivative to be approved. Some bankster dreams it up, and literally the next day, or maybe even the same day, they're out there trying to sell it to you or me or Iceland. So why do we have so much trust in our Wall Street banksters? Especially now? Remember Fabulous Fab, Fabrice Touré, the bankster at Goldman Sachs, who was grilled last year by a Senate subcommittee investigating the financial meltdown? Fab and other banksters came up with a new financial product. They called it Timberwolf, and they sold it to investors. All the while, in their emails, their back-channel emails, talking about how this stuff was a really S-word product. Senator Carl Levin was saying the S-word in front of the whole Senate. Remember that? Can you imagine if a drug company was caught circulating emails before they put a new drug on the market saying, boy, this product is really crummy and it might kill whoever takes it. It sucks. but let's make some money off these suckers. You see, we have laws in place to make sure that drug companies can't do that. But Wall Street can do it all they want. Just today, we heard even more reason why we should be keeping Wall Street on the same kind of short leash that we keep the drug companies. And former Goldman Sachs executive director Greg Smith, he recently resigned from the Goldman Sachs. And today in the New York Times, he's got this op-ed, Why I Am Leaving Goldman Sachs. And in this op-ed, he says, I can honestly say that the environment now is as toxic and destructive as I have ever seen it. He says, I believe if I have worked here long enough to understand the trajectory of its culture, it being Goldman Sachs, its people and its identity, and I can honestly say that the environment now is as toxic and destructive as I've ever seen it. He went on to write that banksters at the firm callously rip off their clients, routinely refer to their customers as Muppets. And most shocking, Smith reveals that the most common question he got from his fellow banksters, how much money did we make off that client? Sad part is, banksters like Goldman Sachs now make up more than a fifth of our economy. They used to make up about a tenth. That means one-fifth of all the money in the United States, or actually it's about almost a quarter. About a quarter of all the money in the United States comes from banksters and Wall Street using unapproved and often dangerous financial instruments that suck money out of the rest of the economy, but make the banksters into literally billionaires. They prey on other Americans, from gambling on oil and food prices to scamming their customers with exploding mortgages and overdraft fees to crashing entire national economies. If they were pharmaceutical companies, they'd be hustling poisons. These people are killing people for profits. This is where financialization or the empowerment of Wall Street has gotten us. A crashed economy, a culture of greed that's unaccountable to the American people. You got Carl Levin there, Jacob, you said? No. Okay. Back in the day, drug companies used to operate in the Wild West with quack doctors traveling from town to town, scamming people into buying their medicine. People get sick, they die. And it hurt the market by sucking out all the trust in medicine. So the government stepped in to regulate it. That's what it should do. That's what we want. That's why we created the government in the first place. Right now, Wall Street is operating in the Wild West. And based on what we've learned about the bankster mentality over the last few years and the unthinkable damage they've caused to tens of millions of Americans and billions of other people around the planet, it's time to make these banksters play by the rules. We got to bring back the Glass-Steagall Act, roll back Phil Graham's Graham-Leach-Bliley bill, which blew up Glass-Steagall. Roll that thing back. Take out the Commodities Futures Modernization Act. Undo what Phil Graham's wife Wendy did when she was the head of the CFTC in 1992 during the George Bush administration, in the waning days of the George Bush elder administration, when she said to Enron, oh, yeah, sure, you can start making derivatives, no problem. And then 5 weeks later, she's on the board of directors of Enron making millions. And we need to strengthen Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank, this brilliant piece of legislation that created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and that starts to put things back together in terms of some sort of regulatory framework after 8 years of the Bush administration totally deregulating the market and giving us a crash.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And we are not going to see these kind of changes like I just described. We're not going to see them happen until we get money out of politics. Go to movetoamend.org for that. So when Carl Levin decided that he was going to look into this thing, and he had Fabulous Fab in front of him and a few other banksters from Goldman Sachs and some of the other big banks, well, here's an example of what they had to say.
You participated in the deal as one of the protection buyers. You don't remember that? You don't remember Timberwolf? You don't remember participating?
No, I remember Timberwolf.
You remember whether you were on the short side?
I remember a few things about Timberwolf.
You remember whether you would have were on the short side? You remember yes or no?
We likely would have provided a number of shorts, and I don't recall if we covered them or not.
All right.
In other words, we were betting against our own product. Selling something short means you're betting against it. And that was Fabulous Fab saying, yeah, while we're selling people Timberwolf, we're also buying bets that it's going to crash and burn. Here's another one.
Let me tell you, the context is mighty clear. June 22 is the date of this email. Boy, that Timberwolf was one deal. How much of that deal did you sell to your clients after June 22, 2007?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, because it would look pretty bad if you said, well, you know, it's $1,400,000 or $400,322,000. No, but you sold a lot of it. Here's Carl Levin again.
You didn't tell him you thought it was a deal.
Well, I didn't say that.
No. Who did? Your people, internally. You knew it was a deal, and that's what your email shows.
I think the context, the message that I took from the email from Mr. Montag was that my performance on that deal wasn't good, and I think the fact that we had lost money related to that wasn't good.
How about the fact that you sold hundreds of millions of that deal after your people knew it was a deal? Does that bother you at all? You sold a customer something?
I don't recall selling hundreds of millions of that deal after that.
If you don't recall it, I can guarantee you, you know, if he hadn't done it, he would have said, I didn't. I don't recall is weasel speak for I'm testifying before Congress and I don't want to get nailed for perjury. Here's one more. Oh, that's it. Okay. So that's all we've got. Anyhow, that's they just give you a sample of it. And then back to our Social Security debate, clip 11, if you've got it, if you can pull this thing up, Jacob. This is Ron Paul telling us that we have a problem. After, you know, everybody knows we've got $2.5 trillion surplus in Social Security right now. Where's he pulling this out of?
Well, you know, Social Security is $6 trillion short of money.
No, sorry, Ron. It is not. Social Security has $2.5 trillion, a little more than that, in the savings account. It's just these guys, you know, but Ron Paul, being a libertarian, he wants to hand that Social Security off to his bankster friends. In fact, he doesn't even think it's constitutional. I thought this clip number 10, Jake, I thought this was a fascinating dialogue between him and a host on Fox News who, you know, basically was helping Ron Paul get the talking points out and knock down the idea that the founders, the George Washington, who signed the first legislation that actually fed poor and homeless people in Washington, D.C., George Washington signed the first welfare bill in the United States. That, well, oh, those founders didn't mean the welfare of the people. They meant the welfare of the billionaires. That's been badly misinterpreted. Here's Ron Paul.
Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, to pay the debts, and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. Doesn't Social Security come under promoting the general welfare?
Absolutely not. That is such an extreme liberal viewpoint that has been mistaught in our schools for so long, and that's what we have to reverse, that very notion that you're presenting.
Congressman, it was the decision of the Supreme Court in 1937 when they said that Social Security was constitutional under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution.
Yeah, and the Constitution and the Court said slavery was legal, too.
Yeah, until we had a civil war. What, you want to have a civil war over Social Security? I'm telling you, there are some libertarians out there who would want to do it, and there are some Republicans. I mean, you ask the question, you know, why, if Eric Cantor isn't a libertarian, why does, well, pretty much any of them, you know, Mitch McConnell, I mean, pick your right-wing Republican. If Paul Ryan, you know, why does he want to voucherize Medicare? If there's no, you can't build a constitutional case about it. Even this right-wing Supreme Court won't stand with you. And on top of that, 230 plus years of American history won't stand with you. Like I said, George Washington actually provided welfare benefits to people in the Washington administration. John Adams in the Adams administration. Thomas Jefferson in the Jefferson administration. James Madison in the Madison administration. James Monroe in the Monroe. I mean, just you can just go through the list. There hasn't never been an American president, never, who hasn't signed legislation to provide benefits to American people to promote the general welfare of the people. Never. And yet these libertarians with this Ayn Rand philosophy of, oh, let every man stand on his own. Well, what about the people who are born with birth defects? What about the people who are hurt on the job? What are the people, what about the 6-year-old kid whose parents die? What about people born into grinding poverty where they don't have the advantages of education or of competent education? I mean, in large part, you know, over the last 30 years, as our educational system has been under assault ever since Ronald Reagan put Bill Bennett, whose campaign for president was that he was going to blow up the Department of Education. So what did Ronald Reagan do? He made him the Secretary of Education, the guy who wants to end public education in the United States. And our schools have been going downhill ever since. But in large part, what we're seeing is as the wealth divide increases, as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, the toxic consequence of that poverty is this whole series of social ills. And those social ills are showing up in our school, you know, divorce and violence and teen pregnancy and drug addiction and mental illness. All of these things go up as the spread between the rich and the poor grows, as the middle class dies. And part of being in the middle class is knowing that you have some security throughout your life. Whether it's being 25 years old and being in a car accident, Social Security will cover you for the rest of your life if you're disabled. Or whether it's turning 66, now I guess it is, turning 65, 66, whatever, and applying for Social Security to retire on. That's part of just the fundamental core stuff of having a middle class. Libertarians don't like that. They want to take us back to Victorian-era England economics.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the insane, well, new vocabulary word, actually, ugly, and your calls. 27 minutes past the hour. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very scolicophagously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for your brain. The good, the U.S. Senate. Despite big oil's chance of drill, baby, drill, the Senate yesterday rejected an amendment that would have opened up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and other protected areas to oil drilling. The amendment was going to be attached to a bill currently under consideration to fund transportation projects nationwide. Given the news last week that the U.S. has more oil than it knows what to do with, there's no reason to be destroying more land just to serve the interests of big oil. Nice to see Washington standing up to corporate greed for once. The bad, U.S. Senator Mitch McConnell. In a heated debate yesterday over the filibustering of 17 judicial nominees, Senate Minority Leader McConnell admitted that while it is unlikely any of the nominees will not be confirmed, he is filibustering them anyway because Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid made him look bad. So basically, McConnell is playing crybaby and holding the confirmation hostage to get back at the evil Senator Reid. And just when you thought politics in Washington couldn't get any more childish. And the very, very ugly. TAPS. TAPS, or the Texas Association of Private and Parochial Schools, is an athletic association consisting of primarily private Christian schools and a few Jewish schools. Recently, private Muslim schools in Texas asked to join the association and were subjected to a series of ignorant and hateful questions. One question asked whether the schools wanted to terminate the infidels. Yes, those words, terminate the infidels. While another asked why Muslims condemn other religions. This is part of a larger attack on Islam in this country, fueled by ignorance and intolerance, and is very, very ugly. In fact, it's mind-bogglingly ugly. What do you do with this? Jerry in Long Island, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Yeah. Thanks very much for taking my call. By the way, I agree that that last thing was very, very ugly. But on Social Security, I have two main points. First of all, when it comes to entitlements such as both Medicare and Social Security, these are not welfare programs. Even though I had a conversation with a woman off the air, she was trying to say these are welfare, and I don't even have high blood pressure. She almost got my blood pressure up. Because these are not welfare programs. These are government programs that people have an absolute right to.
There's not a penny of government money in Social Security or Medicare. They're paid for by the contributions of the people who use them.
Exactly. People pay into them through the...
Or by the taxes of people who use them. But
my second point, though, comes to... when it comes to these programs such as Social Security and Medicare, though,
I'm even more worried about certain Democrats than I am Republicans. Certain Democrats such as Ron Wyden and Mark Warner of Virginia. A lot of people don't know about Mark Warner of Virginia. Other Democrats are buying into this Republican idea that we should raise the age of eligibility for Medicare and for Social Security. And also there's still other Democrats who are seriously considering this idea, this Republican idea of means testing these programs. In my opinion, both of these ideas would be the beginning of the end of these programs as we know them. And
I agree. Let me just give you a quote here, Jerry. This is Peter Ferrara sent us an article that he had written about Social Security, you know, for our debate, and so I could read what his take was.
Yeah, I heard him.
And and from his article, he said he's talking about the president and you know being wanting to keep prevent Social Security from being privatized. And he said, at least he has an excuse. He's busy with the battle of his lifetime to make small but smart changes to another unsustainable federal program with his Ryan Wyden Medicare reforms. And in other words, they're now referring to to Paul Ryan's legislation, which passed both the House and all the Republicans in the Senate voted for, but it didn't pass the Senate, to voucherize Medicare, to destroy Medicare as we know it and turn it into a voucher system. They're calling that the Wyden-Ryan plan. They're putting a Democratic senator's name in front of it because Ron Wyden played the role of useful idiot. I still can't figure out why this man did this. He had to have been on drugs that day to say, well, maybe this is a good idea. This is insane.
Right. And this is what we have to watch out for. This is the whole danger there. We can't let the Democrats join Republicans in nipping around at the edges and making changes and cuts to Medicare, Social Security, or Medicaid, or any of these programs that are going to end up hurting these programs in the long run. And this is why I'm glad that Bernie Sanders voted against the payroll tax cut. That's another problem. We were taking money out of the Social Security Trust Fund. Yeah.
We're not actually taking it out. So far, the government has been basically paying it out of the general fund and has been covering it. But the day will come, mark my words, if the Republicans win the presidential election and if they win control of the House and Senate, that day will come and they will seriously start taking that money out. Jerry, thanks a lot for the call. This, by the way, I mentioned the good, the bad, and the ugly, Mitch McConnell. Filibustering the 17 judges. This is audio clip number 9, Jacob. Here is Senator McConnell in his own words.
This is just a very transparent attempt to try to slam dunk the minority and make them look like they're obstructing things they aren't obstructing. Any effort to make the minority look bad or to slam dunk them that is sort of manufactured, as this is going to, of course, be greeted with resistance.
Yeah. In other words, I'm going after these judicial nominees because you, Harry Reid, tried to make the minority, the Republicans, look bad. Yeah. Okay, I have these 35 things the Democratic Party has brought to us, from Social Security to the minimum wage to the five-day work week to the SEC. What have the Republicans done? Bruce in Stansbury Park, Utah, says he has an idea. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. And I hope the same is true of you.
I just thought of, the Emancipation Proclamation, Eisenhower's interstate highways, Nixon opening up trade with China. You know, I think you have to give the devil his due on these things.
You know, the Emancipation Proclamation, that was a very different Republican Party. The Republican Party in 1856, when it started in Jackson, Michigan, started out as a reform party, an anti-slavery party, and by the 1880s they were purely in the pocket of the railroads and the steel and oil barons, and that was the end of that. But yeah, you're right. The early Republican Party leading up to Lincoln's presidency, and arguably Andrew Jackson's, although he wasn't, he was a Democrat, as I recall, was pretty reasonable. And you're right, Eisenhower with the interstate highway system, that was a good one, although he had a lot of Democrats along with him. He had a democratically controlled House of Representatives throughout his 8 years in as president, so he could not have passed that without Democrats. But
absolutely,
yeah,
and you know the parties have changed their platform substantially over time.
And as Jacob points out, that was 50 years ago. I mean, what have the Republicans done in the last, you know, the last generation, in the last 20 years to help the American people?
Well, how long has it been since the Nixon presidency?
What, 30-some-odd years, I think?
Has it been that long? Well,
it's been a long time. It's been since 74, wasn't it, when Nixon melted down and left office? Is that recall?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, so that's that'll be 70, 80, 90, 100. That'll be 30 years in two. So that's 28 years.
Of course, opening up trade to China is controversial because it helped us get to where we're at right now.
Yeah, that brought us Walmart as we know it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a mixed bag. Okay. Well, it's a good try. Good try, Bruce. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV, and thanks for giving it a shot. Much appreciated. Let me see if any other none of our other callers. It's amazing. I got 12 lines filled here, and not a single caller is saying, I've got something the Republicans did. Danny in Long Island. Hey, Danny, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you? Thanks so much for putting me on.
Thanks for calling.
I wanted to thank you for all the information I get from your show, especially cluing me into this whole Ayn Rand thing. I had never really heard much about it before I heard your talk about it on your show. And so now whenever I see her name online, I pick up on it. I read the articles. And a couple months ago, I read an article that actually discussed in detail how she and her husband, in the latter stages of their lives, actually collected Social Security and Medicare.
That's right.
Because obviously the book did not sell, enough to support them for in a life of luxury. And she actually signed her, her legal, the power of attorney over to someone to execute the acquiring of these benefits. And, the hypocrisy is one thing, but the irony is another. And it's just amazing.
Totally agree with you. Shouldn't everybody in the United States have the same right that Ayn Rand had to take Social Security and Medicare like she did? That's the question to start asking right-wingers, and it'll make their heads explode. So
they all rail against the right to have this stuff until they need it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Thank you very much, Danny. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, you got an Occupy update for us, Mark?
Yeah, Tom. I want to welcome you to your new time slot, by the way.
Thank you. We're pleased to be on Talk 1090 there. What's up?
Well, this is what's going on here. Well, first of all, I wanted to let people know that I'm going to be on NPR tomorrow with Dr. Cornel West talking about the Occupy Wall Street movement and the upcoming presidential election.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to give people a heads up on that. I guess my blog at Daily Coast sparked a lot of controversy on that subject. But
yep.
What I really wanted to call in about was this weekend is another major national Occupy movement conference happening in St. Louis.
Okay.
It's starting actually tomorrow, the 15th, and it's going to go through Sunday. Through the 18th, folks who are going to be forming delegations from cities all over the country to report back on the issues facing the movement, like police repression, student loans, home foreclosures, regulation of Wall Street and the electoral system, all the things that we've been talking about throughout this entire, process that started last September in New York City. And I think it's going to be great. I would invite anybody around the country to come and join us.
What's the website for the information, Mark?
It's OccupyMidwest.org. OccupyMidwest.org.
Okay. Mark, thanks a lot. Great to hear from you. Keep up the great work and say hi to everybody on our behalf. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Have the corporations really completely taken over America, or is there still a flicker of democracy left? I think there's a big flicker left.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Martha Akinsells Martinez. Am I pronouncing that right, Martha?
Yeah, Akinsells Martinez.
Thank you. Is with us on the line with OccupyYourHomes.org, the media liaison for Occupy Your Homes in Minnesota. And tell us what's going on. What are you up to?
Well, today we're having an event in Minneapolis. We're having a block party to invite CEO Richard Davis of U.S. Bank to come and sit down at the negotiating table with homeowners like Monique White and John Vinge, homeowners in Minneapolis who are Richard Davis's neighbors, to negotiate with them to refinance their mortgage so their families can stay in their homes.
Do you expect him to show up?
We hope he's there. It's a friendly invitation, A lot of the work that he's doing foreclosing on homes, and last year in Minnesota, over 25,000 homes were foreclosed on.
Yeah.
It's very impersonal. It's very impersonal.
Well, come on down, Minneapolis. We're live on Minnesota's Progressive Voice right now. And people there can.
Yes, they can join us
at
the Loring Park by the Dandelion Fountain. We're meeting there at 5. And we're going to go visit, have a block party, and invite Richard Javis to join us for a community forum on April 7th to talk about keeping families in their homes and stopping foreclosures.
That's spectacular. Great. Thank you very much for sharing that with us, Martha, and for the great work that you're doing.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for dropping by. That's spectacular. Let's see here. Aisha in Washington, D.C. Hey, Aisha, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, thank you, but I'll get better. How about you?
Well, excellent, and I'm even more excellent with the fact
Good.
That you're live now.
Thank you.
I can finally call you after years of listening to you.
Thank you. What's up?
Yeah, I'm a healthcare worker, and I wanted to make a quick comment about quality of care. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a question between the quality of care here in Germany, but I just wanted to mention to you real quick something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time. I have actually seen a baby pigeon.
No, you haven't. Those are cleverly painted baby doves.
No, seriously, I'm a home care therapist. I was going to a patient's house who lives in a senior citizen center, and she has a balcony.
Mm-hmm.
They used to have a lot of pigeons that land on the balcony.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of the flower pots, this pigeon laid an egg, and for about 4 weeks or so, we watched this pigeon grow. So by the time the thing was old enough to fly up, it looked like a regular pigeon.
You have been duped by the robots from the planet Xenu. Cleverly painted doves.
I have been dying to tell you this for years.
Well, thank you, Aisha.
So
you want to talk about healthcare.
Like I told you, I'm a healthcare worker. My question is, what is the difference in the quality of care between here and Germany? Because I'm going to tell you, the quality of care here stinks. You know, with the amount of patients that we have to see in a day, I have seen an increase over the years. And I can really see sometimes when I'm working with patients, particularly when I used to work in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
the patients were very unhappy with how they had to be shuffled around so quickly.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, in a couple of weeks, we're going to be doing our show live from Germany. I haven't used the German healthcare system in 20 years. And although I've been there a lot and, you know a lot of Germans, and they're very happy with it. And, in fact, a good friend of mine just had surgery there a couple of weeks ago for a back injury he sustained in a car accident. And on the crazed Autobahn they've got there. And, he's very happy with it. And it was free. And it's just top rate. And when I was in a German hospital for a few hours, but, back years ago, everything was brand new. Everything was very spiffy. The people who worked there seemed very enthusiastic and happy to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Workers in general in Germany have great empowerment. The Constitution of Germany requires that any company that has over 1,000 employees, that half of their board of directors has to be made up of representatives of organized labor. And so, workers in Germany have a lot of power in the workplace. And so you just generally don't find disgruntled employees. And if you do, then, they go to some place where they won't be disgruntled. So there's a high standard for employers to meet. I don't know about the healthcare industry specifically itself, and maybe we can get somebody. I'm just talking with Samuel Mueller right now in email about trying to line up some guests for us for our show. I was looking for people who had, financial perspective. What's going on with the euro? What's going on? The whole Europe is crashing thing and all that kind of stuff. But I'll ask him about a healthcare person as well. Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Aisha. Thanks a lot for listening to the show. Adam in Greenwich, Connecticut. Hey, Adam, what's on your mind? We have 1 minute to the end of the show. It's all yours.
Great. Thank you. I just want to say one thing that the Republicans did a Republican president, Ronald Reagan, was. He gave Congress passed amnesty with the Simpson-Mazzoli bill back in 86.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that was, Reagan reluctantly signed it, was given an ironclad, a promise by Congress that they would enforce immigration laws, but 3 million illegal aliens are now, who became citizens, now we have about 12 to 20 illegal aliens, 20
right.
million illegal aliens.
Right. And
I blame
I don't blame that on Reagan signing an amnesty law. I think that that certainly encouraged some people to think, hey, if we can get over there, there'll be another amnesty. But the biggest thing that Reagan did is he stopped the enforcement of laws against employers hiring people who were not legal citizens. And as a consequence of that, there are entire industries, like the meatpacking industry, for example, used to be all unionized. Now it's all, by and large, mostly, recent immigrant or, in many cases, illegal immigrant labor. And the wages have dropped radically, and the meatpacking industry loves it. And this is not a good thing for the United States. And frankly, it's not a good thing for the immigrants, because for legal, illegal, whatever you want to call them, because they're working with the threat of being outed and being harmed. So anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Adam. I do appreciate it. Coming up tomorrow on the program, here we go, Senator Sherrod Brown is going to drop by about protecting American jobs and boosting manufacturing in Ohio, and Dr. Cosmin Blaga, an actual physicist, is going to be here to talk about atomic physics. Don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.